Hey everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Negotiation Podcast. I am your host, Todd Embley, and today I am thrilled to welcome back Ray Ma, a distinguished expert with nearly two decades of working experience in technology and finance in the US and China. She is also the founder and editor of Tech Buzz China, an investment newsletter and boutique media and consulting service aimed at professional investors interested in China tech. Today, Ray provides deep insights into the current landscape of AI, focusing particularly on the competitive dynamics between the US and China. She discusses how geopolitical tensions and export controls have impacted China's AI industry and highlights the resilience and adaptability of Chinese AI firms. Ray shares detailed perspectives on the state of open source collaboration in China's AI ecosystem compared to that in the US and explains the significance of emerging players such as DeepSeek. Additionally, she explores the latest AI advancements from major tech giants like Ant Group and Baidu, as well as the rise of innovative startups like Manus. The conversation also touches on practical AI applications within China, guided by Alibaba's strategy of reducing costs and maximizing use cases. Ray concludes with her thoughts on the future of AI in China, offering an insightful outlook on opportunities and challenges ahead. Listeners should also stay tuned for part two, where Ray will discuss additional key trends shaping the broader tech landscape in China. Enjoy.
China, you don't have someone who is so commandingly in the lead in terms of funds raised, like OpenAI, right? So OpenAI supposedly is closing on their $40 billion fundraising round. Pretty much anyone in China, you're looking at a couple hundred million to maybe a billion. Of course, we don't know exactly how much the giants, you know, Baidu, Tencent, Alibaba have spent internally on their AI efforts, but a lot of those are probably not in R&D. A lot of it is in deployment because they all have very large cloud services. So I would say that it's a much more equal playing field in China, but DeepSeek has been very disruptive by open sourcing their core technologies and kind of forcing the sector to reprice.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to the Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies. Ray, welcome back to the Negotiation Podcast.
Thanks for having me back, Todd.
Okay, so where are you in the world today? You're always somewhere new. Where are you living? Where are we recording you from now?
I'm in Silicon Valley. I'm on the peninsula, to be exact, in the Bay Area in California.
Now, we're going to jump right in because we have a lot to get to. And for those listening, this is going to be a two-parter. So we're going to have part one, and then we're going to have part two. And then because Ray is a mother now twice over, she has to run at a certain amount of time. So we're going to start buzzing through all of these. We're going to do part one today, and then you'll have part two released next week. So Ray, jumping right in. How do you assess the current state of the AI competition between China and the United States? And what are the key strengths and weaknesses of each?
Yeah, well, so I actually do work at an AI startup right now. We do enterprise workflows, or as we call it now, AI agents for enterprises. I think that for AI, I don't know if I have too much to add that's different from what's been reported, but for those of you who haven't been, you know, keeping an eye on it as closely as I have, I would say that in terms of AI, you can think of it as software and hardware, right? And then obviously the US still leads in hardware, with NVIDIA being the de facto choice for anyone and everyone who wants to do anything related to AI. And that's not just LLMs and, you know, foundational models, but also embodied AI, right? Robotics. So everything related to AI, US is still by far, I think, in the lead. China has companies like Huawei trying to catch up, Alibaba, et cetera. But depending on the type of hardware we're talking about, 20 to even 80% less effective. For software, however, I think if we look at US and China, it's actually quite, there's parity. China is probably still a little bit behind in terms of state of the art or frontier bleeding edge models, but that's partly because they have access to less compute, right? NVIDIA being in the lead and the US placing a lot of restrictions on what can be exported. So for the foundational models, China's quite close, but you still have US being in the lead. But China is getting a lot of attention because of players like DeepSeek, open sourcing everything effectively and making it really widely available for anyone, anywhere to use.
Thank you for that. We're going to dive into one thing that you just mentioned, is that restriction on chips. So U.S. export controls affecting China's access to advanced chips. How have Chinese AI firms adapted to those restrictions?
Well, so if you ask some cynical people, they would say they have it and they continue to smuggle in chips. I disagree with that assessment. I think that doesn't make that much sense to me, especially with the giants, right? With your Tencents and Alibabas, that they would go to, the risk of trying to get an unreliable and expensive supply when, they could be going with more legitimate means. And then also, like I said earlier, there are domestic alternatives. They're just not as effective. So for Chinese companies, what you see is that, again, referring to DeepSeek, which has made headlines since earlier this year, what they're doing is they're going towards innovations where you don't have to be so reliant on pure raw compute power, and then you can be much more efficient by effectively optimizing for every step of the way, right? There are multiple steps between, the command and then the execution, translating into machine language, whatever. Multiple steps. And they have done, and by the way, open sourced a lot of that work on making sure every step, like everything that could possibly be optimized could be monetized, or sorry, could be optimized. We wrote about it in the TechBuzz China newsletter, and we kind of cribbed someone else's explanation. And what they did was they basically used the high-speed rail as a metaphor for this system. And what DeepSeek had done, and other players in China as well, but DeepSeek most notably, is you can think of a high-speed rail system as, having nodes, right? Having, there's the rail tracks themselves. There is the load that you can put on the tracks. There are, how many trains you run from where to where, how many cars you have on the train, down to like if you have a luggage system, if you have a check-in system, right? So this metaphor can go quite deep. And Chinese AI companies are literally optimizing every single step of such a system.
So I think an inquiring mind might want to know, okay, so that's a snapshot of how it is right now. But what would you say about the steepness of the curve for each? Let's just say US versus China. We're just talking about them mostly anyway. What is the steepness of the curve of the advancements and the technology with regards to AI that one might want to start to predict maybe the US extending its lead or China catching up and blowing past the US?
I think so there are many theories out there, one of which was like, you reach a point of singularity, right? I'm pretty sure many people have heard about this, where the AI is so intelligent and it's so beyond human brain power that it is now creating more advanced technology and more advanced innovations, and presumably smart enough to keep the ones behind, you know, was maybe, I don't know, maybe sabotage the ones behind, or it's just reached escape velocity in such a way that no one can ever catch up. I just don't think that's the case really with intelligence. As we can see, you know, even when we talk about AI and models and such, and, you know, when you see people benchmarking different AI models and they're breaking it out into which models are best for image generation, which ones are best for text generation or video generation or doing code, which might be different from doing math, you know, which might be different from interacting in different languages. And now we're adding in robotics. So also which models and what's the hardware, the whole integrated system that allows intelligence to interact with the real world, the physical world. So I don't think there's just like one intelligence where there's this one curve we're talking about. It's advancing on all different fronts, and it's advancing in many, many different abilities. So all the ways that humans can be thought of as being quote unquote intelligent, I think AI could be as well. And probably many others that we haven't even thought of that humans can't actually do, right? So I don't believe that that is, I guess, a productive way of looking at it, that there's this one curve.
Fair answer. And I mean, there's tough questions that are, you know, somewhat hard to answer.
And if I want to be like a little bit exact right now, what I would say is right now, right? Earlier, I said those really popular benchmarks for measuring how good your quote unquote AI is. Probably video, China has been pretty dominant in, not saying that there aren't really good models coming out of the US, but I think just because it's ties in nicely with a lot of the work China has done in the past with like computer vision and the fact that like video in general is much more dominant in China. I mean, TikTok, you know, of course, came out of China and they've just been working on it a little bit earlier. That's probably where China has a little bit of an edge, I would say. And then overall applications, right? So you see, because of, again, DeepSeek being a really great accelerant, but overall, I think adoption because of favorable policies, because of this less aversion to having AI replace human workers, whether knowledge or blue collar, I think that in terms of, you know, actually applying the AI, China's kind of a little bit more, I guess, accelerated there.
Let's go back to what you said about open source, which DeepSeek, it was part of kind of what made them a little bit famous. Maybe you could contrast, compare, juxtapose the current state of open source collaboration within China's tech ecosystem with regards to AI, and then how it compares to the US's ecosystem.
Yeah. So with China, you don't have someone who is, you know, so commandingly in the lead in terms of funds raised, like OpenAI, right? So OpenAI supposedly is closing on their $40 billion fundraising round. Pretty much anyone in China, you're looking at a couple hundred million to maybe a billion, something like that. Of course, we don't know exactly how much the giants, you know, Baidu, Tencent, Alibaba have spent internally on their AI efforts, but a lot of those are probably not in, you know, R&D. A lot of it is in deployment because they all have very large cloud services. So I would say that it's a much more equal playing field in China, but DeepSeek has been very disruptive by open sourcing their core technologies and kind of forcing the sector to reprice. So even before they got famous earlier this year, actually in May of 2024, when they released the previous version, so V2, they became known as the Pinduoduo, or for those of you who are not familiar with Pinduoduo, then Temu of China.
Same company.
But also same value proposition of being extremely cheap. So they really forced everyone to lower their prices because they were cheaper by, you know, 90%+ because of these optimizations and because their business structure is different. I think that for the US, Yeah, you really have, it's very obvious, you know, working in the AI space, you really have OpenAI as just far and away sort of the lead in terms of mind share, in terms of funds raised, in terms of talent. They're able to recruit. Whether or not that has fully translated into the robustness of the models, I don't know if that fully matters, actually. They just have a ton of users and a lot of revenue that's growing very quickly still. And then you have the other players like Anthropic, et cetera. In terms of applications, because a lot of Chinese companies, I think, saw that, and you see this in the past decade, that enterprises are far less willing to pay for AI. You see a lot more Chinese companies taking one of two ways. One is sort of producing a more consumer experience. So there are not that many companies in China, for example, doing what we do, which is enterprise AI deployments. A lot more doing products targeted towards individual consumers or small businesses. And then a lot of them going abroad, right? So some of the most popular AI apps, HeyGen, for example, Opus Clip, et cetera, those are actually Chinese teams. But they targeted international users from day one, knowing that the monetization internationally was just much better, that the willingness to pay was much higher. So I would say those ecosystems look different. Yeah. Whereas in the US, you still have sort of the SaaS model in terms of there are still many companies that are really targeting more enterprise usage. And then you have the runaway hits like your Cursors and, you know, much more smaller than them, Lovables, et cetera, that are tackling individual applications very profitably. And in this case, the most profitable application of AI right now is coding. So using AI to generate more software.
We have talked a lot about DeepSeek, and I was going to ask you something about its origin and its significance, things like this. But I think we've talked about DeepSeek kind of enough. And I want to actually go on to some of the other players. And we know that Ant Group, which is Alibaba, for those who don't know, and Baidu, welcome back to the stage, Baidu, have also recently made headlines with AI advancements. What are your thoughts on their latest developments? And can you talk about what they are?
Yeah, we're actually writing a piece on Alibaba's models right now. I would say that you can think of it as Baidu was probably the earliest to say they were going to go all in on AI. And they have been less impressive, I think, than some of the other players. And that's been a common problem they've had, where they pick sort of the right strategic direction, but have a little bit of trouble executing. Alibaba has done surprisingly well, however, for a company that, I don't know how many listeners are very familiar with Alibaba, that really has commerce at its core and a bunch of non-technical founders as the sort of the soul of the company, Jack Ma and whatnot. They've done a really good job being able to attract and identify talent. Their models have also been open source since the beginning. They use slightly different licensing than DeepSeek, but it's still a very, very permissive license. So you can really build on top of it as an individual developer or even another corporation. And Alibaba also has invested a ton into their cloud services. So they're the leading cloud provider in China. They're really like the AWS in terms of, right, their combination of commerce and cloud. And they've really not ceded any ground, and I think probably made a little bit of a gain. We'll see what the latest reports show in terms of that part of their business relative to their competitors. I think what is really interesting about Alibaba is that they've also been focused on their making their models smaller so that they could be deployed more at the edge. And that's the latest, I would say, the very, very latest. And AI is like changing every week. So this literally happened like, I think, a week ago. So by the time this podcast is out, maybe 2 weeks, that their latest models could potentially be deployed on a smartphone. And yes, one of DeepSeek's models, you can also distill it and whatever and have it also run on a laptop. But being able to get really good performance, right, that we're all used to with these AI assistants right on your smartphone without, for example, being able to be, without having to go through the cloud, that would be a really big deal. That might not be that important for smartphone users because we do have, ubiquitous, well, at least China has ubiquitous 5G. many of us have other, less than 5G. But, like for robots, for example, that could be really, really altering, or cars, for example.
I love the cars coming out of China right now, all the EVs.
But you can't buy them either, right? Isn't there like a very high tariff?
Yeah, no, we cannot. Which is so unfortunate, looking at these amazing cars, gull wing doors, hand motion TVs, and just voice activation, everything. And oh my gosh, it's just, and they're like $35,000 US. Beyond Baidu, Alibaba, DeepSeek, let's talk about the emerging key players in the China AI sector. Who should we be watching? For example, Manus.
Is that how they pronounce their name?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
When I see A-N-U-S.
Yes.
And then I'm just putting an M in front of it. I don't know. It could be Manus.
So I actually was lucky enough to get one of their invite codes the day after they launched. And I've tried it a few times. I would say they are... they have a very smooth interface and it is an AI agent. So for your listeners who don't know what that is, they kind of made the news, were not nearly as viral or impactful as something like DeepSeek, but they made front page headlines for having a really slick AI agent that is, general purpose, right? So you could just kind of tell it to do anything. It wasn't relegated to some specific task. You could, tell it to do pretty much anything that you can think of that involved, your computer and the internet, and it would go and try to do that. I would say I don't consider that one of the, true innovations coming out of Chinese tech right now, because there are lots of other alternatives. Not as nicely done in terms of UI and maybe the user experience per se, but I think that is not necessarily a really, really large moat that they have there. So what I can say is that it's very obvious that with the new reasoning models that have come out, such as DeepSeek's R1 and, all the new Anthropic and OpenAI models are all reasoning based, where the AI will tell you how it's going about completing the task, right? So you can see its logic, and then it will actually backtrack, right? It won't just like give you an answer. It will try these multiple paths and it will decide when it's done with the answer. That's very different and a paradigm shift from what we had before for these AI assistants. So now I think we're going to see that really take off, right? That's what we're doing at our startup. And that is what pretty much I think everyone can expect from every single AI application that they're going to see in the future. And Manus is just one consumer-facing application of that. But expect to see that everywhere.
For those who weren't 100% sure that Ray was deeply involved in the startup world, she just used a term called their moat. For those who may not understand what that means, it is your defensibility, your secret sauce, your what protects the main
I don't know, the main castle from being attacked or borrowed, so to speak. So yeah, we often use the term back from our startup days of having a moat or creating a moat, which is how you protect yourself and what you're doing, so that you're different. Ray, would you agree with that fumbling example of what or description of what moat meant?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Thank you. So Alibaba's chairman, Zhou Tsai, talked about the importance of bringing down costs and maximizing AI applications. Now, where are we seeing AI applications being rolled out in China? And will we see similar application scenarios in the West?
Well, we see it everywhere in both the US and China. It's more like a question of speed. So the difference between, I think, what's happening in China right now with DeepSeek, because it is open source and therefore much more customizable, much more secure for, paranoid large companies, is that the speed of adoption could potentially be faster, right? Again, we're still very new into this sort of cycle of adoption. But for example, in our DeepSeek report, and I kind of feel bad like singling them out as this, it almost sounds like there's nothing else in AI besides DeepSeek and OpenAI, but it is a little bit true because they really just represent, right, two different ways of doing business, one of which the U.S. kind of dominates in, one of which China is trying to go towards, right?
Well, there's Bitcoin and there's Ethereum and then there's everything else.
I wouldn't say it's necessarily that successful yet. But what we can see where China's ecosystem is going is that once you have this very cheap, very cost effective, very, transparent and flexible system that is also very intelligent, then you're going to have all sorts of sectors rushing in to adopt it because they don't have to worry too much about costs. They don't have to worry about security because they can just have their own engineering resources work with their proprietary data. And they don't have to worry about sending it to a player like OpenAI, right? So for China, you see, I think it's like basically substantially all of the car manufacturers, all of the smartphone makers, and all of the cloud providers, but of course they were going to deploy that immediately anyways. But just on cars and smartphones, you see substantially all of them announce within, I think it was like 3 weeks of R1's release, that they had started on or had already integrated, AI into their products. Now, of course, like it's not always at the same depth, right? And then you also see that even players that have their own foundational model efforts, like Tencent, right, the owner of WeChat, they also announced that they were integrating DeepSeek and integrated immediately into their AI assistant. That AI assistant, by the way, grew 20-fold from February to March of this year. So in 1 month, it 20x'd, mainly because they put in reasoning models such as DeepSeek R1 in there. So that's what we're seeing in terms of adoption in China. In the U.S., it's really the same, right? You also have car manufacturers and smartphone makers, I mean, Apple Intelligence, like whatnot, talking about the integration. It's just taking a little bit longer, I think, for us to see pilots because they are working with largely proprietary models. And of course, manufacturing in general is just slower in the West. Of course, you see AI being deployed in finance, in healthcare, right, and in education, mostly used by students, I think, to try to do their homework. these are all the same in China. So the universal need for AI to help you understand massive amounts of information or, do homework problems, but basically like search the breadth of human knowledge. That's there in both China and the US and Canada. So China and the rest of the world, I should say.
Yeah, pretty much. I know. It's absolutely incredible. I don't know if I'm scared or thrilled yet. I'm still kind of, the jury's out on that. I just think about everything that AI can do, and then I still can't, you know, not burn my garlic bread in the oven. So I'm just very kind of worried about these things. But yeah, I don't know. We'll see. And I was going to mention, we talked about the singularity. If I remember correctly, I thought the singularity wasn't so much of a thing. It was a time in the future when computing power would bypass the ability of the human brain. Wasn't that going to be the point in time that was called the singularity? Am I getting that right?
I think so. Yeah. Technological growth becomes uncontrollable and irreversible, resulting in unforeseeable consequences for human civilization. That is what Wikipedia means. Yeah. So it's basically, yeah, it's a point in time when that happens.
Yeah. Okay. Now we're going to put a bow on part one. Any final comments on AI in China? Optimistic, pessimistic? I think you've done a really good job, even in this first episode, of kind of stabilizing and normalizing maybe, you know, fears and conspiracy theories and people. You've kind of brought it back and just said, listen, it's pretty even. It's all pretty good. Nobody's taking over the world yet. But any final comments on AI in China? Optimistic, pessimistic outlook?
Yeah, I would say overall, I personally obviously am optimistic that I work in the industry. But I think that there is a little bit of a difference between how people socially, right, view AI in both places. And I would say that overall, there's definitely panic across, you know, just anywhere in the world, right? Especially parents thinking like, what the heck do I tell my kids what they should study? Because my understanding of the world may not be what actually applies when, you know, they're grown up and they're looking for jobs, or will jobs even exist and whatnot. So that does exist, but I think it's more low key in China. I do think that there is a little bit more optimism. I made a joke on Twitter recently, but it's not really fully a joke, because I did see comments like this on my, you know, WeChat moments and Weibo versus Twitter and, you know, Facebook feed. I saw that in China, it tended to see a little bit more things like, oh, AI's here. How are you going to learn more STEM, right? Because clearly this has been so world altering already. Our kids should do things that, you know, it's even beyond AI. And the example I gave was theoretical physics. Truly a parent in my WeChat really did say that. And, you know, lots of other people commented and they were like, that makes sense, right? Because again, AI is kind of currently synthesizing existing knowledge. It's not creating new knowledge. And that's what they meant by theoretical physics, because you're, you know, exploring. Right. Oh, sorry. You're exploring what's, in string theory, whatever. You're exploring what's unknown. Whereas in the U.S., and this I can say definitively is the dominant position, because I've seen this just like so many times. The common answer is you should have your kids study plumbing. Like, oh, you know, coders will be replaced soon. And this is with a lot of Silicon Valley people, but, you know, plumbers won't be anytime replaced, or plumbers won't be replaced anytime soon. And those are just two wildly different ways of looking at the impact of AI.
We definitely need to make trades more sexy for young people. I completely agree. And I'm going to close reminding people of something very smart, intuitive, and future looking that I heard from an old business colleague of yours, Dave McClure. Gosh, had to be 10 years ago. Had Dave at a conference. We were doing a little SOS which was the fund I used to work with. We were having an event just for alumni and for mentors and for all these things that we used to do. And we had him in San Francisco. And somebody from the audience asked him about his daughter, saying, "Is your daughter learning how to code?" And Dave took a second to kind of parse that and reframe it and say, "What I think you're asking me is, do you think it's important for young people to learn how to program?" He said, "Yes." He's like, "Is my daughter learning how to code?" "Yes, but that's kind of her choice. I really wouldn't care what language she chose to learn at this point, because it's all to me about how the brain develops. And that's an very, very important aspect of helping more branches grow in different directions. But do I think it's ultimately important for her future? No. What I would advise is that people understand human behavior. That is probably more important than anything else that you could possibly teach your kids or have them understand by the time they become adults." And I thought that was very well said and very well answered by Dave at the time. And every minute that goes by, I always agree with what he said. So we are going to end part one there. We're going to put a pin in it, come back next week for part two. But from me and from Ray and from everybody at The Negotiation, thanks for listening to us on part one and or watching, and we'll see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.